My castaway this week is a writer. He was born the clever and only son of a Pennsylvanian schoolteacher and lived a quiet provincial life until he went to Harvard at the age of 18. His desire to write drew him to the New Yorker magazine. He became a staff writer there in the 50s, and in 1960 he published Rabbit Run. It was this book, together with the three later Rabbit novels, which contributed to his reputation as one of modern America's most important writers. Couples, his novel about marital infidelities in the 60s, made him a millionaire, and The Witches of Eastwick became a major feature film. Today, at 63, he remains a witty, thoughtful, but always sure-footed observer of America's changing way of life. Of his own life, he has this to say: "It's been a struggle to become normal, but I think I'm getting there." He is John Updike. What's abnormal about a decent, God-fearing Pennsylvanian boy who grows up to become a famous and prolific writer?
Well, I felt growing up that we were not quite normal, but perhaps it was my mother's writing ambition, which I thought was abnormal. She did have this itch to be a writer, and sure enough, I caught it. I was an only child, and to that extent, I missed some of the stimulations that my more prolific family friends had.
So you felt abnormal because you were outside of the pack, did you?
I did.
But what was abnormal about your mother wanting to write?
Oh, I thought it was very abnormal. I mean, nobody else in that county wanted to write. The most normal thing was to be a good athlete, which I wasn't, and the height of professions around there was to be a full-fashioned knitter. So I don't know. I began to stutter at a fairly early age out of some sense of abnormality. And then I got psoriasis quite early, a skin disease that never used to be discussed, indeed pronounced. Now it's rather more out in the open. I've kind of come out of the psoriasis closet, but I think that helped me feel abnormal.
So you've tried to become normal. What is normal today, now you're 63?
To be psoriasis-free and to stutter only under stress and to have written 40 books and have had 4 children and 2 wives, and I moved out of New York City, which is a very abnormal place, and moved to what I thought was a more normal kind of America, and really tried to create out of my suburban environment in my 30s the kind of identity I think I longed for as a schoolboy.
I want to revisit some of those places, both normal and abnormal, with you, if I may. But first of all, we're going to put you in a very abnormal situation, because what we do here is send you alone to a desert island with only your music for company. Does the idea appeal at all?
As an only child, I'm not totally afraid of a desert island, and it'll be very good for my skin, I expect, if it's a sunny island. Hearing the same music over and over again is a little intimidating, but I've tried to pick pieces that I could bear to hear at least twice.
Tell me about the first one.
First one is Fats Waller singing "You're Not the Only Oyster in the Stew." A good friend of mine and I somehow discovered jazz when we were about 11 or 12. He was the one with a lawyer for a father, so he had the money for the equipment and the records. But I used to go over to his house and listen. For both of us, it was a window into a totally other world than Shillington, all white Shillington. Somewhere, Larkin talks about a giant yes that floats down from the playing of Sidney Bechet, and I suppose I felt that same giant yes in Fats Waller.
You're not the only oyster in the stew. Not the only tea leaf in the tea. However, I'm convinced, completely, fully, firmly convinced, you're the only one for me. You're not the only wriggle in the prune. You're not the only apple on the tree. Still in all of fact, perfectly logical, positive fact, you're the only one for me. So well supplied, the bird things I see. Oh, mercy, baby, your smile is refreshing. Kisses so unique. When I'm round, I'm susceptible and weak. I love you, so to speak.
Fats Waller singing "You're Not the Only Oyster in the Stew." You've written a lot about your own life. You've written a lot about American, everyday, average, normal life. a lot of you in your short stories, but I want to talk, first of all, if we may, about the Rabbit books. Where did Rabbit, Harry Angstrom, come from? Because he wasn't you. He's nothing to do with you, is he?
Well, he was born in the same county, and in a sense, he went to the same schools that I did. He was a year younger than I. The figure of the ex-athlete, the young American who peaks at the age of 18 and has nowhere to go but downhill, was very real to me, and I set out of heaven knows what mingled set of impulses at the age of 26 to write a saga of one of these young men to whom adult life is an anticlimax.
Quite, because he's really rather a shallow character. He's pathetic, really, isn't he, Butcher?
As we age together, though, Harry got increasingly more charming, I think. Yes, in the first novel, The Rabbit Run, he's fairly shallow.
But do you like him?
Yeah, I liked him. A lot of readers didn't. One person tore the book up and sent it to me, and I don't think accused me of being the Antichrist, but did accuse me of being a really sick person to have written this book.
But why would they have thought it was sick?
Well, because the fellow's sexual urges are rather more spelled out than they tended to be in the fiction of that innocent long-ago era.
That was 1960 you first wrote about him. You went on to write about him every 10 years after that, and he won you 2 Pulitzer Prizes. Why did you kill him off? You killed him off in 1991
I thought his time had come. I thought it was very much in the nature of being an ex-athlete that he might die young.
Of chocolate and hamburgers?
Yes, of overeating, basically, of self-indulgence. The whole death was much on my mind. My mother was dying or very ill, and of course I'm always aware of my own death in me, like a baby getting bigger every day. But her illness, whatever morbid tendencies I have, her very authentic descent into old age was certainly there to remind me. I was trying to be a good son and shuttle back and forth to Pennsylvania. She was living alone. I felt guilty. I didn't quite know what the guilt-free path open to me was, and out of this mix of feelings, depressing realities, and her own hospitalization, which occurred about midway through my writing of the book, really helped the book because I was able to observe a hospital up close. But anyway, she certainly is the secret of the book, in a way.
Tell me about record number 2.
A little later in my jazz period, if I can call it that, I somehow heard the Benny Goodman recording of the 38 Carnegie Hall concert, and Sing, 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 which is the longest section of it all, is the riff that the pianist Jess Stacy takes after hearing a number of other trumpet, clarinet, etc. riffs. The story I've later read is that he was listening to Debussy somewhat before this concert, and when his term came to shine, the Debussy filtered into this jazz tune. It's really a marvelous, magical passage, a minute or two in the history of jazz.
Benny Goodman and his band with Jess Stacy on piano playing Sing, Sing, Sing. And that was recorded live at the Carnegie Hall in 1938. Tell me more, John Updike, about your childhood. The time spent anywhere in Shillington was delicious, you've written. Why so?
Or it seemed so later. It probably was very mixed, a mixed diet like every other existence. Old-fashioned days, unlocked doors, left your key in the car, a child could walk anywhere.
You were in on your mother's secrets, weren't you? She wanted to know what you thought about this writing she did.
I was sort of an editor. I became, at a very early age, an in-house editor, and I used to read her stuff from about the age of 12 or so on and would try to comment usefully about it. I suffered with her, really. I suffered, I think. And so, as far as
the
child...
The rejection slips.
Yeah, the rejection slips.
But your relationship with your mother was obviously very close, not least because of this psoriasis you suffered from, this skin condition. I just have a picture of you, I think, obviously culled from your own memoir that you've written, that you didn't go off with the boys on a summer's afternoon fishing in nothing but your short trousers, that you were at home with your mother, lying in the garden desperately trying to get rid of your psoriasis.
Well, that is an image, and there's some truth in it. It's true I did not like fishing. I thought it was a terribly cruel thing to do to these poor silvery fish, to tempt them with food, and then they wake up with a hook in their mouths. So, no, I never fished. I never went to summer camp either. I don't think we can blame this on the psoriasis, really. I just was a kind of timid, fastidious boy.
But you were ashamed of your body, weren't you, for a long time? Inevitably, I mean, it was covered with scaly bits.
Well, it was, but only seasonally, you know. It did sort of go away, and I don't think I internalized it absolutely.
But it must have made your adolescence excruciatingly painful.
It had this little kink in it, yes, that other people didn't have, but then there were other problems they had that I didn't. But yes, undoubtedly, it helped me become... a writer, in that I didn't mind seclusion. I really had to find a profession I thought that would permit a certain amount of seclusion, hiding. A writer can look quite hideous, you know, and as long as, because you only deal with the mailman, basically, the corner grocer.
So, the rejection slip.
So this secrecy, yes, this hiding and sending out these missives to the world, I guess, suited my psoriatic temperament.
And did it, let me ask you a very personal question, did it make your virginity any the more difficult to lose?
I was fairly slow by today's standards to lose it, but
we were all slow by today's standards.
At college, I courted a girl. I wasn't sexless. And the college girl, when I explained my terrible secret, rather dismissed it, and she had thought I was going to tell her much worse things. So psoriasis, let's hope, is never quite as bad to other people as it seems to the person who bears it.
Record number 3.
In emerging from latency, I began to fall in love with movie stars, and I fell in love with Doris Day and remain really in love with Doris Day. And of her many songs, I think with a song in my heart. Doris Day was somewhat sneered at least in the States, and not so much over here, I think, but she really had a marvelous voice, and it does make the hair on my neck stand up always when I hear it, and probably will this time.
With a song in my heart, I behold your adorable face. Just a song at the start, and it soon is a hymn to your grace. When the music swells, I'm touching your hand.
Doris Day singing With a Song in My Heart by Rodgers and Hart. How old were you when you first identified that the New Yorker was where your ambitions lay?
I think about the time I fell in love with Doris Day, I also fell in love with the New Yorker, maybe a little earlier, come to think of it. We were still in the Shillington house, which we left when I was 13, when the New Yorker began to arrive, courtesy of my Aunt Mary of Greenwich, Connecticut. She was my father's sister and several notches up in the sophistication ladder.
She thought you should read this magazine.
She thought we should. Maybe she thought my mother should read it, too. Then I just liked the look of the magazine. I liked the type and the chastity of the author's name being only at the bottom. And there was a whole lot of coolness. You know, cool was a plus word in those days. And the New Yorker was, to me, seemed very cool. So I don't know what point I began to try to write New Yorker, quote, short stories, but certainly by college I was sending them things, and at the end of college they took a story.
I was going to say, when was the moment? I mean, you must remember it after all this history of rejection slips.
Yes, everything was coming back. But in college, it began to come back with little notes on it, which was a sign of breakthrough. The ice was beginning to crack. The river was beginning to break up. And the very June I got out of college and I set about the serious business of becoming a real writer, the very first story I wrote, called The Friends from Philadelphia, they actually took. And it was in Pennsylvania that I received word. I think the amount of money was $550, which seemed quite sizable in those days.
And was your mother there at the time?
Yes, my mother was there. We were all in the house, and she shared my delight, as a good mother should. She had to stand there and watch as I slowly ascended to the heights of published, somewhat known writer, and I suppose it couldn't have been easy for her. She later told me in a burst of frankness that she just assumed that it had been her instead of me, but since it was me, we were all very happy.
More music.
When the moment came, I thought, to leave New York, we moved to a small town on the North Shore, north of Boston, called Ipswich. There, we joined a lot of things. We joined a set of couples, all of whom had small children. The children were a great link among us. And one of the things we joined was a recorder group. Both my first wife and I learned, in a fashion, to play the recorder. And we played a lot of arrangements of Renaissance music, Purcell, Byrd. But the best and, in a way, the easiest to play was the Bach. I think most of the fugues in the Well-Tempered Clavier, written for the organ or the clavier, have been transposed to recorder music. And although I'd had piano lessons as a child, this was my first real experience of being inside music and the sense of the mounting and the way the things return and build and come back in another key and all that conversation within that music does was never real to me until I began to play Bach's fugues on the recorder.
Fugue number one from Bach's Well-Tempered Clavier, played by Blandine Ferlet. And memories of being in an adult recorder group, 1957 onwards, in Ipswich, Massachusetts, where you say, you've written, you ceased to become a radically defective person. What was it about life in Ipswich, Mass, that made you so whole?
Well, I think we should give credit is due to my first wife, who, just by consenting to marry me and bearing my children, enlisted me in humanity in a fairly forceful fashion. And really, without Mary's forbearance and encouragement, I don't think I could have quite pulled it off about becoming a writer. And then we moved to this small town where our family was very like others, 50s marriages, married pretty young, most of us, had children quite early, and really astonishing when you look back. By the time I was 28, I was the father of four. And by the time young men are 28 now, they usually haven't married even. Various groups, recorded group was only one of them. There was a political discussion group in which we debated whether Harry should have dropped the A-bomb, and there were some book groups, and anyway.
But it wasn't all serious stuff. I mean, there were kind of fancy dress parties.
There was a lot of fun.
Maybe clam bakes.
Some would say there might have been too much fun in the end, but no, parties were one of the things.
I wanted to get to the bit that might be too much fun, because this is where the book Couples was born, really, wasn't it?
Yes, Couples is, it's not untrue to say that Couples was in part based upon the Ipswich experience, although I took pains to make no one person identifiable. I mean, to that extent, it's fabulous, maybe too fabulous, but it was a kind of fable spun from the
But presumably,
suburban life of that era.
But presumably within this community that you describe, where there was a kind of, I think you've said yourself, there was a mutual invasion of privacy. I mean, that did lead on to, I don't know, wife swapping, or was it just simple adultery?
There were never any key parties in my crowd. Everything was covert. What Couples was trying to describe was really a sort of community situation rather than a sexual situation. The sex was part of the communal effort. It was an era, pre-60s, early 60s, when revolution was nowhere near in sight, and yet we'd all kind of didn't have much faith in any of the standing institutions or even our own jobs. Sex will rear its head almost anywhere you give it half a chance, and certainly it had at least a half a chance there. And we were too young, too old for the 60s, but it became our version of the revolution in a way, and indeed we did sort of dress like that. The women dressed in miniskirts, and the men began to dress down into vests and T-shirts, and I even had some love beads. I don't know whatever happened to them. I sometimes wonder, where are my love beads now?
Record number 5.
A part of my Ipswich life in those years was to sock the psoriasis with a dose of sun, which was the only cure. I would go to the Caribbean, sometimes with my wife, once or twice with my entire family, often alone. And it was in the Caribbean that I first heard steel drum music on Anguilla. The boy down the road would play this, practice it to himself at night. It was the first time I'd heard a steel drum played. I never tired of hearing it. It always seemed very magical to me there. When you hear it in a northern climate, it's a little less magical, but I certainly wouldn't mind hearing it again.
Yellow Bird, played by the original Trinidad Steel Band. Your marriage, John Updike, in fact broke down finally after some 20 years or so and 4 children. You've written that it felt like the worst thing you ever did. Do you think it probably was, even now, 20 years on?
Yes, I haven't done anything as painful since. I'm an observer, you know, of life's passing parade, and have taken rather few decisions. One of them was to leave New York with my wife's agreement, and another one was without her agreement, leaving her and the 4 children. They were oldish, but by no means adults, and I thought that if now was the moment, if ever, that there would never be a pain-free time, and I'd like to think it's worked out fairly well. My first wife has remarried happily. My children are all married and so on. Nevertheless, yeah, it was dreadful to have caused so much grief and so much loneliness. The sense of a fatherless household 30 miles away remains with me as an awful thing. Yet it seemed necessary. Well, what can I say? It's a very successful first marriage, seems to me. As somewhere a New Yorker cartoon says that, and I think that would be a fair description of my own first marriage. It was a very successful one.
But you say you're an observer, and that's what I wanted to ask you about, really, because, you know, you've since written about the breakup of a marriage. It seems to me that no friend or relation or acquaintance of a novelist is ever free, are they? I mean, however intimate the experience that you have with them, you can always end up on the page.
There is that risk, yes, yeah. So you should pick your friends carefully, and if you have a great thing about privacy, you shouldn't include a working fiction writer among your friends.
But do you think it makes people wary of you?
I've never noticed that it did. You know, I became a character in my mother's fiction, and never thought that she really got me right at all. So I'm sure people feel that way about mine, and to which the only defense is I wasn't trying to do justice to you. I was trying to create a fictional character. And
if you then attempt to write nonfiction, and you have in your memoir, for example, do you think that you rewrite history at that time? Do you think you don't quite recapture it as it was?
I became, for the purposes of that memoir, a kind of fictional character myself. It didn't feel so different than if I was writing fiction in an odd way.
So did it become fictional, therefore?
Possibly. Possibly. It certainly is a greatly simplified version of my life with many things left out. If there is a future biographer, I want to get this on the record before he or she says anything.
Do you hope there will be?
No, I don't look forward to that. And certainly during my lifetime, I'll do what I can to frustrate any biography. My life, fortunately, has kind of been basically dull. And nobody has really come on in an invasive way.
More music.
Yes, it wouldn't do to have only pop tunes on this desert island, and we must have some Mozart. In trying to sift through it in my own mind, and I'm not a very musically educated person. In fact, my wife wanted me to reassure the listeners that I really hate music and always ask her to turn the radio off. But when I'm not writing, I'm happy to listen to Mozart, and certainly I'd be extra happy to listen to Piano Concerto No. 21 on my desert island.
Part of Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 21, played and conducted by Vladimir Ashkenazy with the Philharmonia Orchestra. You've always written to order, haven't you, John Updike? You've set yourself a quota and you've done it, and at that stage you can take the day off if that's what you want to do. You're an ordered man.
Somewhat orderly, or maybe I impose this order because I'm not so orderly, but being fortunate enough to be able to be a freelance writer and not to be saddled with academic duties, I thought the least I could do would be to try to maintain a business-like schedule. And I quite early drew up the following rules: to work in the morning and to rest content with 3 pages.
But describe to me the process of writing, because your prose can read as if it's been honed and honed again. I think somebody said, one of the critics, that your sentences have a stuffed perfection. I'm not quite sure that's entirely complimentary. How much do you work on them and work over them again and again?
I'm not a great rewriter, actually. I try, of course, each go at it to make it better and to read it afresh, because a writer is just a reader turned inside out, and you go from being writer to reader very rapidly.
But what your detractors say, and there aren't many of them.
No, there are enough.
Everybody agrees you're a brilliant technical writer. What the detractors say is that the fact that there is this stuffed perfection about a lot of your prose means that it's not as easy to read as it might. It makes a demanding read. It's somebody said that the miraculous lacquer of your prose sometimes gets between you, the novelist, and the reader. You're too good for your own good, is actually what they're saying.
Well, there may be some truth in all this. I don't mind making demands of the reader. I think the good stuff does make demands on us, actually, the stuff that's worth rereading.
Record number 7.
At one point in our Ipswich existence, I thought we were in danger of becoming provincial, and Couples, which came out in 68, also did make a fair amount of money, I mean, certainly more money than I had ever made before, or since, for that matter. And I felt I could afford the luxury of taking my family abroad. Where better than to go in those days than London? So we lived here from September of 68 to June of 69. The Beatles were in there. We didn't know it then. They were in there. Their last years, they were very much around. We actually saw Paul looking quite unshaven from a bus one time. And I especially remember of that year, toward the end of it, Hey Jude came out. It's a great song of farewell, isn't it? Farewell to London, farewell to the Beatles, as it turns out, and mounts in a way that most of this music does, to a kind of ecstasy. It really is a thrilling piece, showing the Beatles at their most adventurous and offhand at the same time.
Hey Jude, don't make it bad. Take a sad song and make it better. Remember to let her into your heart. Then you can start to make it better.
Hey Jude by the Beatles. You live nowadays in the same house you've lived in for 13 years. You live with your second wife, 30 miles north of Boston. 5 grandsons and another on the way, you said.
That's true.
How's the social life?
Not much of it.
So life is a tame business these days.
Tame business. But I'm trying to work. I'm approaching the twilight of my working career, and I'm grateful. I'm trying to be as diligent as I can.
Why do you say that?
Oh, I don't know. What am I? I'm 63, and how many writers write good stuff after 63? Rather few, if you look at the curve. A lot are dead at 63. Shakespeare, for one. Milton,
but writing,
I think, for another.
But writing is an ageless business, isn't it? I mean, you can be promising. They call you promising for years.
You stay young and promising for quite a while, well into your 40s, and then suddenly the promise is gone, and they wonder why you haven't done more, and people are bored with you, and you get reviews like, here's another Updike. Oh, boy, they say. Same old stuff. And, you know, you're trying not to repeat yourself, but, of course, in being true to yourself, you tend to, surprise, surprise, come up, just like your handwriting continues to repeat, so your writing does.
Will you write on your desert island, or will you stop because there's no one there to read it?
No, I think I would continue to write if I'm allowed to have the tools. I have a hard time picturing this existence, and I... but yes, I might scratch out something on the inside of some bark if I could.
So it's a self-fulfilling process. It doesn't matter if nobody reads it. You just need to write it.
It's a help if somebody reads it, and even more of a help if somebody pays you for it. But it gets to be a habit, you know. It's like a kind of a secretion that you must produce, or you begin to feel poisoned.
Last record.
Lastly, at the risk of seeming to take with me a bunch of old chestnuts, I did think that Beethoven should come along, as well as Mozart. Beethoven, who took the music from the sublime to the personally powerful. I recently had to listen to, at a concert, to Beethoven's 5th. The way the music doesn't want to end, it's almost like a life struggling to stay alive. And the way he keeps saying the same thing. There are a number of places in the last movement where you think it's over, and it's not. He goes back and does it again. It's like a man who can't stop telling you something. And it's so beautiful, and the passion, and it makes you think about music in general. That is, what is this message that music is so anxious to get to us?
End of Beethoven's 5th Symphony, played by the Philharmonia Orchestra, conducted by Otto Klemperer. If you could only take one of those records, John.
That's a very tough choice, my goodness. But at the risk of seeming Philistine, I think I'd have to vote for the Goodman. It's intricate enough, I think. I would not weary of it too soon. Also, it's a young me I'd be taking instead of the older me.
Benny Goodman and Sing, Sing, Sing. What about your book? You've got the Bible and you've got Shakespeare there already.
Well, that should be enough for anybody, one would think, but if I'm allowed a third, and you can find Proust in one volume, let me take that. The glory of Proust's way of seeing and saying, just a permanent inspiration to me, and I didn't really become a writer until I'd begun to read Proust.
And your luxury?
What is a luxury? You know, one man's luxury is another man's necessity. But what came to my mind, something I've never had and probably will never have, is a silken tent. And I would use it not for shelter, because that would make it a necessity, but I'd use it as a place to repair to. It would be somewhat translucent. You could see the sun and the sky through it. But also, there would be a weave within the silken sides that would contain images, great paintings of The Last Judgment, some old Mickey Mouse stills. I'd always be surprised by what's in there. There would always be something new to see within my silken tent.
And you'd only go in there when you didn't have to.
Right, only when I didn't have to, and I'd never go in there for simple shelter. Whenever it rained, I would stay out and take my soaking.
John Updike, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you.